Just a little fancier. More polished, perhaps. She stood in the doorway and leaned against the frame.
Well, what do you think?
I had to push away that big tangle of feelings again before I could answer. This is quite satisfactory.
I'm glad you like it. Now let's go upstairs and get you dressed before your date gets here.
Chapter 10. George. This felt oddly like high school. I stood on June Tucker's porch, half expecting her father to open the door and ask about my intentions with his daughter. Why, I wasn't sure. June was a grown woman, and I didn't think she lived with her parents. There were three cars parked outside, two in the driveway and one on the street. Maybe she had roommates, although from what I knew of her, she didn't seem like the roommate type. Her house was tidy, with a small front porch and a dark red door. Lights glowed through the cracks in the curtains. A tickle of nervousness ran up my spine. I cracked a smile at that. When was the last time I got nervous before a date? Maybe that was why this reminded me of being a teenager. It wasn't Sheriff Tucker who answered my knock, but it wasn't June either. I recognized the man who opened the door as one of the Bodines from the other day. He'd been grilling in the back of that pickup truck. What was he doing here?
Hey, GT,
he said, opening the door and standing aside.
Come on in.
Thanks.
Jonah Bodine,
he said.
We met the other day. I'm June's roommate.
Right, the grill in the truck. He grinned.
Yeah, my brothers are, well, there's never a dull moment.
It was a good burger.
Yeah, thanks. I think June will be down in a second. She's upstairs with her sister. Make yourself at home.
Jonah went into the kitchen where he had something sizzling on the stove. Smelled good, like soy sauce and ginger. June's house was nothing like I'd pictured it, cozier than I'd expected. The living room had a brick fireplace and a couch with big fluffy pillows and throw blankets. Another chair sat near the window, and there were several bookshelves stuffed with books. I wandered over to the fireplace. She had a few pictures on her mantle. One was her and the woman I'd seen at the bar last night. Must have been her sister. Another had the girls with their parents. Sheriff Tucker stood behind June, and a woman who was clearly their mother was on the other side. The third photo was June with her father. In all of them, June wore the same subdued smile, just a subtle turning of her lips. It was so distinctly her. At first glance, she appeared emotionless, but I could see the depth hiding behind those pretty eyes. There was a lot more to June Tucker than one might see at first glance. And if she'd let me, I wanted to be the guy to uncover it. Footsteps coming down the stairs made me turn. It was like something out of an 80s flick. June took each step carefully, as if she were moving in slow motion. She was dressed in a black V-neck top that hugged her curves beautifully. Dark jeans with ankle boots. Her dirty blonde hair hung in waves around her face. Her green eyes were bright, her lips shiny and pink. I watched, captivated, as she made her way down the stairs. Her sister followed, but stopped about halfway down.
Wow, I said. You look beautiful.
Cassidy did my makeup.
She stood still at the bottom of the stairs, as if her feet had gotten stuck.
I wasn't sure it was necessary, but she made a compelling enough argument that I agreed.
I closed the distance between us. You look nice all the time, but she did a great job. June leaned closer to me and took a deep breath through her nose.
You smell extremely pleasant tonight.
From the corner of my eye, I saw Cassidy wince.
Thank you.
I leaned down, putting my face near her hair, and inhaled deeply.
You smell extremely pleasant as well. Have we talked about the impact of scent on the brain?
I don't recall that we have.
We should. It's remarkable. I put my nose in her hair and smelled her again. Her scent went straight to my head like a good shot of whiskey. I read once that our sense of smell is directly connected to the limbic system.
The oldest part of the brain,
June said, her voice breathy. The primitive part of the brain. Since she wasn't moving away, I took another deep breath. God, she smelled good. It was about then that I remembered we weren't alone. Jonah stood in the doorway to the kitchen, and Cassidy was still on the steps. Both were staring at us, open-mouthed. I kept my attention on June. Shall we?
Yes.
I offered my arm, but she hesitated, drawing her eyebrows together and looking at me with confusion. I grabbed her hand and tucked it into the crook of my elbow.
Oh, right.
Her hand was small against my arm, her fingernails cut short and unpolished. She was as natural as a woman came, this one, and I loved that about her. No games, no agenda. So different from the women who'd always surrounded us when I played football. I tipped my chin to Jonah and Cassidy.
Have a good evening.
Night, you two,
Cassidy said with a smile. She wiggled her fingers at her sister. I led June to my car and opened the passenger side door, closing it after she got in. She sat with her back stiff, her hands clasped in her lap. I couldn't quite tell if she was nervous or if that was just how June sat when she was in a car. She'd relaxed quickly enough when we'd danced last night. Feeling her melt into me as we'd swayed to the music had been enormously gratifying. I could tell June was going to be a bit of a mystery. She wasn't like most girls, and if I wanted to get to know her better, I was going to have to play by her rules. I didn't mind. She was intriguing. A little awkward and often blunt, but intriguing nonetheless. A challenge. I was a competitive guy. I couldn't resist a good challenge. We pulled into the parking lot of the Bowl and Skate. It was packed full of cars, but I found a spot off to the side. June glanced at me.
Bowling or roller skating? I should warn you, I'm not proficient at either of those activities, and it appears to be busy.
We're not here to bowl, I said. Or skate. There's a bowling tournament tonight. I figured we could be spectators. It's not exactly a football game, or even baseball for that matter, but it's the best I could do on short notice.
June smiled. Her lips parted, the corners turning up in an honest-to-goodness smile. It lit up her face, making her eyes sparkle, made me feel like I'd just scored a game-winning touchdown.
We're here to watch bowling?
That we are. Sound good?
Yes, it sounds great.
I got out of the car, but she was out before I could get around to open the door for her. I made up for it by holding the door open when we went into the bowling alley. The rumble of bowling balls rolling down the lanes and the crack of falling pins filled the air. Every lane was full, a colorful motley of people in garish bowling league shirts. The scent of onion rings, fries, and beer mingled with the disinfectant the attendants sprayed into the rental shoes to keep them clean. Someone bowled a strike in lane 4, and the team erupted with cheers. I put my hand on the small of June's back and led her through a knot of people. Most of the crowd was down near the lanes. There weren't a lot of spectators, so we found a small table near the shoe counter. Several laminated menus were stacked on one end of the table. I handed one to June and took a look at the selections. Pretty standard bowling alley fare. It all sounded good to me. Onion rings were definitely happening.
What looks good?
I asked. She tilted her head as she studied the menu.
I'm partial to just about everything they offer, particularly onion rings.
Onion rings? Damn, I liked her. I'm with you there. There wasn't a waitstaff, so I got up and ordered at the bar. I brought back a pitcher of beer and poured two glasses. June watched the bowlers, her eyes roaming across the scoreboards. I wondered what was going through that sharp mind of hers. The bartender brought our food. It smelled greasy and delicious, and we both dug in. I never would have thought watching a bowling tournament could be this enjoyable, but just watching June have fun, listening to her calculations and predictions, was fascinating.
She knew things about the origins of bowling, because of course she did. Her eyes were bright and her smile lit up the room as she scarfed down fried food and watched the tournament. Made me think back on other dates I'd had. Expensive restaurants with fancy menus, exclusive clubs, VIP treatment. Those days had held a certain appeal. It was fun to be treated like you were a big shot. Even I could admit that. But I'd never been so relaxed on a date before. I could kick back, stuff my face with onion rings and fries, and just chill. No pressure. No wondering if my date was only with me for my status or my money. June was a fan, but she didn't seem to give two shits about my fame, and it was one more thing on a growing list of reasons I liked her. "Have you picked a winner yet?" I asked, gesturing to the teams.
"It's likely to be I Can't Believe It's Not Gutter."
I glanced at the scoreboards. "Huh, looks like they're in third. You think they'll pull ahead?"
"Their strongest players bowl last in the rotation, so I suspect their score will improve considerably in the later stages of the game."
"Can't argue with that logic." We watched a bit longer, finishing our meal. I needed to use the restroom, so I excused myself, leaving June at our table. When I came out of the restroom, the thunder of bowling balls had been replaced by loud voices. An argument had broken out between the teams in lane 6 and 7. A group of players in bright fuchsia bowling shirts, the pin pushers, squared off with the ball busters in neon green. Most of the other bowlers had stopped playing, their attention on the altercation. I glanced around, wondering if there was a league official or a manager who could step in. Did bowling tournaments have refs?
"He was over the line,"
a man in fuchsia said, jabbing his finger at one of his opponents in green.
"It's a foul. No points."
"Bull honky, he was not over the line. It's a spare."
A woman walked straight into the fray, a woman who looked disturbingly like June. I shot a quick glance at our table. Empty. It was June. Oh, hell no. I was not letting my woman get in the middle of a throwdown at a bowling tournament. Wait, when had I started thinking of June as my woman? I didn't have time to contemplate that now. Seeing her stride into the middle of what looked like a fight waiting to happen had me ready to hurtle over the barrier to get to her. I was hit with a surge of adrenaline and I balled my hands into fists as I followed her onto the bowling floor. The man in green's face was red and his voice shook.
"Now you listen here."
"I'm done listening to this nonsense."
The man in fuchsia jabbed his finger at the opposing team again.
"You try to get away with this every year. I'm not having it."
June got right between them. I wanted to grab her by the waist and haul her out of there. Keep those crazy bowlers from touching her. What was she doing?
"Gentlemen,"
June said, her voice filled with authority. She held out her arms as if to keep the two teams away from each other.
"Let's look at this logically. If the pin pushers did indeed have a spare, the relative results of the game won't change. They're currently in fourth place, and a spare won't move their score high enough to take third."
"But if they get another strike, that spare could kick them over the edge,"
the man in green said. June rolled her eyes as if she couldn't understand why she was having to explain something so simple to these people.
"The points differential is already too high. The spare in question isn't significant to the overall scores, not this late in the game."
"But
as long as none of your team members deviate from your current average, your position in third is secure,"
June said. The man in fuchsia crossed his arms, his brow furrowing. I grabbed June's hand to pull her out of there.
"She means don't mess up and they can't beat you."
That seemed to pacify him. He shot the man in green one last glare, then both teams went back to their lanes. I put my arm around June and gently led her back to our table.
"Well, that was some unexpected excitement."
"And kids think math isn't important."
I laughed. This girl was something else. You showed them, didn't you?
Chapter 11. June. George certainly knew how to take a woman on a date. Although my dating experience was limited, it wasn't non-existent, and this had been the best date I'd ever had. I'd assumed he'd take me to dinner, which would have involved a need for a great deal of conversation. Looking back on how I'd felt prior to George's arrival at my house, much of my anxiety had stemmed from the fear that I'd be unable to maintain a mutually satisfying conversation for the duration of a meal. But he'd chosen an alternative that had not only been more comfortable, it had been exceedingly enjoyable. He offered me his arm again as we departed from our table near the shoe counter. This time, he placed his other hand, that large, strong hand, over mine and squeezed. His skin was warm, but not uncomfortably so, and his touch made me want to lean closer, feel more. It was odd that despite George's size, his presence in my personal space didn't feel intrusive. In fact, since I'd settled the scoring dispute between the pin pushers and the ball busters, he'd become increasingly physical. He'd led me away from the bowlers with his arm around my shoulders in a gesture that had felt protective, maybe even possessive. I'd liked it. We left the bowling skate and drove home. He pulled up in front of my house and turned off the engine. A wave of disappointment crashed through me as he got out of the car. This was it. The date was over, or on the verge of being so. In mere moments, I'd be back inside my house and George would be gone. I couldn't explain why I found the notion of saying goodnight so depressing. There was nothing logical about the cascade of negative emotion that washed over me. It was just a date. It wasn't as if we had to say goodbye for an extended period of time. My brain seemed to understand the reality of our situation. It was very likely I'd see him again as early as tomorrow. But there was another part of me, a part that seemed to reject logic and reason in favor of the power of all these feelings, that hated the idea of our night together ending. Graham had always said that when faced with an unpleasant situation, it was best to just pluck the whole chicken. In this case, there weren't any actual chickens involved, but I understood what she'd meant. I got out and walked straight for my porch, trying to fish my house key out of my handbag as I went. George was right behind me. I could practically feel his presence at my back. My heart beat faster, and I once again felt vaguely nauseated. "Thank you for taking me on a date," I said as I fumbled for my key. "I had a nice time."
"June?"
His voice brought me up short, and I tilted my head back so I could look up at him. "Yes."
"Are you all right?"
"I'm fine. Why wouldn't I be?" He shrugged, just a subtle lift of his shoulders, and didn't break eye contact.
"I don't know. I guess that's why I'm asking. You seem like you're in a hurry to go."
"The date's over."
"Is it?"
Realization dawned on me, and the roiling in my stomach intensified. He expected me to invite him in. He'd taken me out on a date and believed it would end with sexual intercourse. It felt as if the blood was draining from my face. I had no problem with people, women or men, who chose to have sexual relations on a first date, or second, if that's what this was, and last night's drink at the lookout counted as our first. But physical intimacy was complicated for me, and that wasn't something I wanted to have to explain to George tonight. Was that why he'd taken me out? Was his primary aim to get in my pants, as Scarlett would say? He blinked once, his eyes still on mine, his gaze intense. I expected him to move closer, to crowd me with his large size. But he didn't. His expression softened, and one corner of his mouth twitched, as if he were about to smile.
"I told you, Junebug. I'm not a man who pushes human mating rituals too far. I know you're going inside without me tonight."
Hearing him use my favorite nickname did strange things to my insides. It made me feel warm and melty, but the gooey feeling warred with guilt over making the assumption that he'd only taken me out on a date for sex. I glanced down. "I'm sorry I had the wrong impression." He touched my chin with his fingertip and brought my gaze back up to his.
"Don't be. We're still getting to know each other."
"If you've not already become aware, I think it's only fair that I inform you of something." His brow furrowed, and I'd never realized how intensely sexy that looked on a man.
"What?"
"I'm not very good at this."
"Not good at what? Saying goodnight?"
I shook my head. "Dating.
He smiled, running the pad of his finger along my jaw.
I think you're doing just fine.
Thank you. You as well. You're clearly quite proficient.
At human mating rituals?
Yes.
I'm not sure I am.
He traced that magical finger from my forehead down my temple and tucked my hair behind my ear. Why not?
It's our second date, and I haven't kissed you yet. Or is it our third? Even worse.
Well, one could argue... He put his finger against my lips.
Yes, we could argue about whether we've had a date before tonight. But I'd much rather just kiss you. What do you think?
Kissing on my front porch did sound appealing. My eyes traveled to his mouth. His lips were full, the corners lifting. I nodded and he moved his finger from my lips. My heart beat furiously. If not for my solid understanding of human anatomy, I'd have wondered if it could bruise itself against my ribs. My fingers and toes tingled, and I couldn't take my eyes off George's mouth. Those lips, that rugged, square jaw, and those dimples in his cheeks. He brushed my hair back from my face again, tucking the other side behind my ear. What a mysteriously charming gesture. Instinctively, I tilted my chin up, angling my face to better receive his lips against mine. Judging by his incoming trajectory, it seemed the optimal angle would be... And then our mouths touched, and my mind went blank. Soft, wet lips exerted gentle pressure against mine, and my eyes fluttered closed. His hand moved around to the back of my head, his fingers sliding through my hair. A tingling sensation spread across my skin, intensified by the scratchiness of his stubble. Without conscious thought, I reached for him, letting my hands rest against his torso. My fingertips and palms discovered ridges of muscle beneath his shirt. The combination of rough and soft, hard and warm, made a shiver race down my spine and heat pool in my core. He sucked my lower lip into his mouth and traced it with his tongue. I clutched his shirt, drawing him closer, and his grip on me tightened. Our tongues touched, first just the tips, then they slid against each other in a long, languid stroke that practically made my knees buckle. A low noise vibrated in his throat, a hum that was nearly a growl. He pulled me closer, wrapping his arms around my much smaller frame, enveloping me. There was skin and movement and the scruff on his jaw, warm tongues and wet mouths. He was also overwhelming, drowning me in a flood of sensation. His grip on my head loosened as he gradually drew back. I tried to follow. I wasn't ready to stop kissing yet. I felt him smile against my mouth before kissing me again. One last, breathtaking, soul-stealing kiss. As he pulled away from me, I was briefly disoriented. I blinked a few times and reached out to touch the door, as if the solid wood could ground me in reality. The cascade of physical sensations still stimulating my nervous system was almost too much to process.
"Can I call you?"
George asked. "What? Oh, no." He leaned back slightly, his eyebrows shooting upward.
No.
We have yet to exchange phone numbers. It would be impossible for you to call me. He smiled.
You're right. I worded that question wrong. Can I have your number so I can call you?
Yes, of course you can. We exchanged numbers. My heart still beating so hard it made the blood roar in my ears.
I'll call you, he said. Good night, Junebug.
Good night, George. I went inside and shut the door behind me. Jonah glanced up from the couch. The TV was on.
Hey, Junie, how was your date?
Magical. Chapter 12, June. George did call, the very next day.
Cassidy was quite impressed, and to be truthful, I was as well. He didn't seem like the type of man who'd promise to call if he didn't mean it. But from what I knew of men, that was a common problem, and I wasn't very good at reading people. He asked to see me again, and I certainly harbored no objections. The next thing I knew, an entire week had gone by, and I'd spent time with George every single day. Saturday evening rolled around, and I needed to make my weekly trip to the pop-in. Normally, I would have gone much earlier. It was getting quite late, but I'd been with George all day. My schedule was in complete disarray after sharing so many meals with him, but I didn't mind. I transferred some unused items to the freezer, reworked my plan for the coming week, and made a truncated shopping list. Problem solved. Besides, it was worth disrupting my routine for dates with George. I parked in front of the pop-in, but as I walked in, I almost ran into my sister coming out the door. "Junie," she said, sounding surprised. She was dressed in her deputy uniform. "Are you on duty?" "No, I just got off, but I was about to call you." "Why?" She glanced around, then lowered her voice. "Something's happened with the Callie Kendall case. Something huge. Bowie's family is coming over to our place so I can explain." I glanced down at the shopping bag in her hand. "What's that?" "Dessert," she said. I felt like, well, this is big news, and I thought we'd all appreciate some sugar to go with it. "What's the news?" She glanced around again. Was she concerned about being overheard? "There's no one here to listen in on our conversation," I said. "I think you can speak free." "I know, Junie." She grabbed my arm and pulled me away from the door. "But this is a big deal. Word's gonna get out soon, but I can't believe I'm about to say this aloud." She paused, taking a deep breath. "Callie Kendall's been found." I blinked at her, unsure of what to say. "Is that a joke or sarcasm of some kind? Because you know I don't get sarcasm." "No, it's not sarcasm. Just come to my house, all right? I'll explain it to everyone all at once." I wasn't sure how to respond to that. Had she really said Callie Kendall had been found? So I didn't try. I simply went to my car and followed Cassidy to her house. She and Bowie shared what had once been a duplex. They'd embarked on a remodeling project to join their two halves into one. The new design was spacious and open, now that most of the central wall was gone. It was decidedly less dusty than the last time I'd visited, but there were still power tools and stacks of building supplies and lumber. Cassidy's cat, Eddie, bounded down the stairs, passing my sister on her way up to change her clothes. My nose tickled at the very sight of him. I was allergic to pet dander, particularly of the feline variety. Usually I came prepared with tissues, but this had been a surprise detour. I sniffed, hoping her two cats would keep their distance. A hum of anticipation thrummed through me as I waited for everyone to arrive, processing what Cassidy had said. I'd once estimated the chance of the Callie Kendall case being solved at less than 4%, with a rate of decrease of 0.06% per year. In other words, I was surprised by this news. Bowie came down dressed in a waffle-knit shirt and jeans. Cassidy was just behind him in a loose-fitting blue sweater and leggings. She pulled her hair up into a ponytail as she walked. "Hey, Junie," Bowie said. Cassidy's other cat, George Cat. I call him George Cat now to differentiate between human George and feline George, twined around my legs and rubbed his face against my shoe. "I don't understand why your cats find me so interesting," I said. "It's as if they have an instinctual drive to bother the people least likely to give them attention." "They're just being friendly," Cassidy said. "Come here, George. Leave June alone. You'll make her sneeze." I took a seat on the couch in their newly expanded living room. Although the chaos of the remodeling project was still in evidence, their house was quite livable. Cozy, even. It didn't take long for the rest of the Bodines and their significant others, for those who had them, to arrive. Scarlett and Devlin, Jameson and Liam A. Jonah was there, dressed like he'd just left the gym. Gibson arrived last, smelling of wood and stain. He must have been working when Cassidy called. "Thanks for coming, y'all," Cassidy said. She stood in front of the group gathered around her, some seated on the couch or chairs, others on the floor. Gibson stood next to me, leaning against the wall.
There's really no way to take the shock out of what I'm about to say, so I'm just going to go ahead and say it. Callie Kendall was found this morning.
There was a shocked silence, lasting the space of a heartbeat, before the room erupted with noise, everyone asking questions at once.
Are you serious? Where? Who found her? What happened?
Bowie held his hands up for quiet.
Come on now, quiet down and let her talk.
It's fine. We reacted the same way at the station when we got the news, Cassidy said.
Here's what I know. She was picked up early this morning on a highway outside a little town called Hollis Corner, about 5 hours from here. Didn't have anything with her, just the clothes on her back. The trucker took her to the nearest hospital. They contacted local police and her parents.
Oh, my God, Scarlett said, through her hands covering her mouth. Cassidy took a deep breath. I could tell by the way she stood that she was tired.
Once the hospital staff gave the all clear, the local cops interviewed her. Took a long statement. After that, they called us. Are they sure it's her?
Devlin asked.
Judge Kendall came out himself and gave a positive ID, Cassidy said.
What happened to her? Scarlett asked. This is killing me. Why did she disappear?
According to the report she gave the Hollis Corner police, she'd met a guy online. He was older, in his 20s, so she didn't tell anyone. He convinced her to run away with him.
What? Scarlett shrieked.
Cassidy nodded. She didn't go home that night because she was running away to be with him. She cut through the woods and hitched a ride out of town, trying to get to Perrinville. The guy she'd met had a bus ticket waiting for her.
Why in the hell didn't he just come get her himself? Scarlett asked.
I don't know, Cassidy said. The report doesn't answer that. Maybe he didn't have a car.
She hitched a ride? Jameson asked.
I could almost hear the unasked follow-up question. Had it been their father who'd picked her up?
She said your dad stopped and gave her a ride.
Shit,
Jameson said under his breath.
They didn't make it all the way to Perrinville, Cassidy continued. About a mile outside town, he almost hit a deer, slammed on the brakes to avoid it. She hit her face on the dash.
Blood on her sweater, Scarlett said under her breath.
Yep. The report isn't clear on what happened at that point exactly or why her cardigan was left behind, only that she continued into town on foot and caught the bus.
This could explain the presence of her fingerprints in your mother's car, I said.
It could, although I don't know why he would have been driving our mom's car,
Bowie said.
We know he drove it a few days later,
Jameson said.
Maybe his truck was broken down at the time.
Bowie shrugged.
It could have been. I don't remember for sure.
Wait, Scarlett said. If Callie ran off with some guy she met online, why'd she disappear for so long? Did she marry him and move to Australia or something?
No, I don't think she married him, Cassidy said.
Not legally, anyhow.
It turns out the guy she'd met was in a cult.
What? Scarlett shrieked again, and Devlin rubbed her back as if to calm her.
Yep. He lured her into running away with him and kept her prisoner at the compound where they lived. Wouldn't let her leave.
She finally escaped this morning.
How?
Jonah asked.
The report says that a couple of days ago the cult leader decided they had to move. She described the situation at their compound as chaotic. It sounds like they were all scrambling to get out of there before they were attacked by demons or something.
Cassidy shook her head.
Anyway, Callie hid, and they left without her.
Did they come back for her?
Jonah asked.
She didn't know. The Hollis Corner police have been assuring my dad all day that they have everything under control.
Cassidy rolled her eyes. but they don't know either. Even I could tell Cassidy was being sarcastic. Where is she now? Scarlett asked. Still at the hospital? Nope, Cassidy said. Judge Kendall whisked her out of there as soon as she was discharged. They just let her go? Scarlett asked. She was a missing person, not a suspect in a crime, Cassidy said. And she didn't have any injuries that warranted hospitalization. With a positive identification from her father, there was no reason to keep her there. If it had been me on the scene, I'd have done more, asked more questions, taken fingerprints, something. Wait, they didn't take fingerprints? Devlin asked. Cassidy rolled her eyes again. The notes in the report say they had a hard time getting her to cooperate due to her traumatized state. I think they had to really coax the story out of her, and once her dad showed up, he wouldn't let anyone near her. I guess it makes sense for her father to try to protect her, Jonas said. I know, and I don't mean to be callous about it, Cassidy said. I just don't think the Hollis Corner Police Department did their job as well as they should have. I can't believe this, Scarlett said. Callie's alive. The room went quiet for a long moment. It seemed as if everyone was struggling to digest this news. This had deep ramifications for the Bodine family. Their father's name would be cleared, not to mention what it was going to mean for the town as a whole. Bowie put his arm around Cassidy, and she leaned against his chest. Scarlett shook her head slowly while Devlin rubbed her back. Jameson held Leah May's hand in both of his. Jonas stared at the floor. He'd arrived in town around the same time his late father had become a person of interest in the case. I'd always had the impression he didn't think much of the man he'd been named for.
You all right, Gibbs?
Scarlett asked. All eyes moved to Gibson. His arms were crossed and his icy blue gaze was fixed on something near his feet.
That's it, then, he said, his voice a low growl.
I couldn't tell if it was a statement or a question. He turned and walked out the door, and it banged shut behind him.
Please don't tell me he's mad because Dad's innocent, Scarlett said. I mean, I know he was involved if he gave her a ride. Don't know what he was thinking there, but he didn't do anything terribly wrong. Callie could have told him anything to convince him to drive her to Perrinville.
Giving a teenage girl a ride out of town ain't exactly good judgment, Bowie said, but it certainly doesn't seem like he did anything malicious.
Gibbs needs to let go of some of that anger he's so keen on holding, Scarlett said. It ain't healthy.
Yeah, well, I don't know if that's possible at this point, Bowie said.
Why didn't Dad tell anyone? Scarlett asked. All those years, he knew the truth and he never told. Why would he do that?
Maybe he was afraid he'd be a suspect, Bowie said.
Or maybe he'd been drinking,
Jameson said quietly.
He could have been worried about getting in trouble for that, too.
Could have been both, Bowie said. What I don't understand is why he kept her sweater.
Maybe he thought it would be important someday, Jameson said.
Scarlett pounded the couch cushion with her fist. I'm so angry with Dad right now. I suspect he harbored a great deal of guilt over keeping that secret, whatever his reasons, I said.
Yeah, you're probably right, Scarlett said.
Thanks, Junie.
That must have been a terrible secret to keep,
Jonah said. Everyone went quiet for a moment. Jonah himself was a secret their father had kept. I was about to point that out when Jameson spoke.
Do you reckon Mom knew the truth?
I bet she didn't, Bowie said. She'd have made Dad come forward, and we already know he kept things from her.
Jonah cleared his throat. Bowie patted him on the back.
I think I speak for everyone when I say I'm glad your one secret that's no longer hidden.
Hell yes to that, Scarlett said. She reached over and squeezed his arm.
Even if you are yet another brother.
Jonah smiled.
Thanks, Scar. Thanks, y'all.
Scarlet sagged against Devlin. I feel like I'm in shock. I don't know what to think right now.
It's gonna take time to sink in,
Bowie said.
And we need to talk to Jamie just to make sure there aren't any more legal ramifications we need to know about.
I guess Callie's parents were wrong about her, Leah May said. They must be feeling so many things tonight having her back. Even I felt a pang of emotion at that. Her parents had not only believed her dead, they'd always maintained that their daughter had committed suicide. To have her suddenly alive must have been both shocking and joyous for her family.
What do you say we have a toast?
Bowie asked before disappearing into the kitchen. Cassidy followed him, and they returned with a bottle of whiskey and glasses. Bowie poured a small measure of the amber liquid for each of us, and Cassidy passed them out. Bowie raised his glass.
To Callie Kendall. May her return to her family and society be as smooth and happy as possible.
To Callie, we all said, then swallowed our whiskey. I turned the glass in my hand, listening as the conversation continued. They speculated about what Callie's life had been like, living with a cult, how the man she'd met had managed to lure her in, where the cult had gone, and whether the police would ever track them down. But there was something tickling the back of my mind. Something about Callie's story that poked at me, like a puzzle piece that didn't quite fit. I wasn't sure why, but I had a nagging suspicion that there was more to her story that had yet to be told.
Chapter 13. George. It was late when my phone rang, June's call surprising me. We'd had brunch together and taken a chilly walk down by the lake earlier. She'd told me she was busy tonight, so I was on the couch in pajama pants watching a movie when she called. The sight of her number on my screen made me smile.
Hey, June.
I apologize for the unexpectedness of my call, she said.
No need to apologize. I'm glad you called. What's up?
I've been made aware of some surprising news this evening.
Is everything okay? She took a breath.
Yes, it's okay.
That's good. Do you want to come over and tell me about it?
I think I do, yes.
Come on over. I'll text you the address.
Thank you.
About 5 minutes later, I heard her pull up outside. She knocked, and I let her in. Hi there. I took her hand in mine as I shut the door behind her, brought it to my lips for a kiss.
Hello. I like it when you do that.
What, this? I kissed the backs of her fingers again.
Yes, that. It feels very nice.
I leaned in to kiss her lips this time, but didn't linger. She'd come over to talk, and I could see the tightness around her eyes. I gestured to the couch, and we both sat.
What's going on? You said everything is okay, but you seem a little keyed up. Are you aware of the Callie Kendall case? She asked.
Little bit, I said. She's the girl who went missing?
Yes, it will be 13 years ago this summer. She was found this morning.
My eyebrows lifted. Found alive? She nodded.
Yes, surprisingly. The odds weren't high, but it's important to note that although statistics can predict the probability of outcomes, there are still those instances that make up the minority portion.
Right. Even if there's a 99% chance of something, there's still that pesky 1%.
Precisely.
What happened to her, do you know? June went on to explain what she'd learned from her sister. I'd heard a bit about the case from Shelby and seen the missing persons posters around town. The picture June painted was stunning, but stranger things had happened.
The town is going to... Actually, I'm having a hard time predicting what they'll do, she said.
I expect they'll be happy she's alive and also want to know every detail they can get.
Without a doubt, this is arguably the biggest thing that's happened in Bootleg Springs since she disappeared.
I took her hand in mine, mostly just because I liked touching her. Think it's in the news yet?
As of about 30 minutes ago, media coverage was very limited, she said. I expect that will change in the morning.
I expect you're right. Media coverage didn't change the next day. It exploded. Saturday night, there'd been a few news sites reporting on the possibility that Callie Kendall had been found. One even had a few photos taken outside the hospital as she was leaving with her father. By Sunday morning, the story was everywhere, all the way up to the national news. At first, reports were short and filled with disclaimers that they were following up on this breaking news story. Monday morning, the Kendall family released a brief statement expressing their gratitude in having their daughter home and asking for privacy for their family. Reporters, however, appeared to be intent on getting their story, regardless of requests for privacy. They'd no doubt camped outside the Kendall home in Richmond to get a few photos of her, mostly entering or exiting a vehicle that began to circulate. The media descended on Bootleg Springs, too, although not in the numbers I'd expected. June said something cryptic about having dealt with those vultures. And I figured most reporters and bloggers would be trying to get more out of Callie and her family, not so much the residents of Bootleg Springs. By Wednesday, there didn't seem to be a soul in Bootleg who wasn't talking about the miraculous return of Callie Kendall. People put balloons and banners all over town. Tables were brought out lining the sidewalks, and by lunchtime they were filled with casseroles, platters, and piles of desserts. The mayor declared it a public holiday. The bank closed, as did the schools. Outside the Kendall house, people left flowers and tied balloons to the fence post. The residents of Bootleg bundled up against the cold and shared food and drinks with their neighbors. They toasted and hugged and reminisced and theorized. It was quite the sight. I texted Shelby some photos. She was disappointed she wasn't here, but said she was happy for the town. We both were. Seeing the community come together like this restored my faith in humanity by quite a bit. The commotion settled down, and after a few days, life seemed to go on as normal. I got together with Jonah Bodine to work out a few times, soaked in one of the hot springs, not the secret one. I still didn't know how to get to the online sign-up form, and I didn't want to get caught over there again. I turned down an invitation to a charity event in Pittsburgh, asked Andrea to send a donation instead. I chatted with locals, had an impromptu drink at the Lookout with Bowie Bodine, watched ESPN with June, had her over to my place for a stay-in date night. All in all, I was settling into a routine here in Bootleg. I'd already stayed longer than I'd planned. I'd originally rented my place for 2 weeks, and I'd gone well beyond that now. I was doing things that felt suspiciously like putting down some roots. Shallow ones, yet, but this had already become more than a vacation. I looked out the front room window of my rental. I had a partial view of the lake, obscured by some trees. The sky was gray, the water glassy and still. It was pretty out there, calm and peaceful. Not for the first time, I thought about how much I liked this town. But it wasn't just the town that I liked, and I knew that wasn't the reason I'd stayed so long. I hadn't counted on meeting someone out here in the mountains of West Virginia. I certainly hadn't imagined I'd meet someone like June Tucker. How could I have? She was as unusual as the day was long, and damn it, I loved that about her. Sure, she was blunt, and sometimes she looked at me like I baffled her, but her bluntness meant she wasn't a bullshitter. I trusted her, and that wasn't something that came easy to me. Not after 10 years playing football surrounded by groupies. Hell, the cleat chasers had started following me around in college, even before I was getting paid to catch a ball. I'd hated sitting across from a woman wondering if there was any part of me she liked besides my fame and my money. There usually hadn't been. I opened the refrigerator door and winced at the emptiness that greeted me. I had an almost empty container of half and half, a few condiments, and a pepperoni roll I'd brought home yesterday. When I'd first arrived in Bootleg, I'd had a number of surprise visitors showing up at my door bearing casseroles and desserts. Between that and takeout, I'd kept myself well fed. However, supplies were running low, and my steady stream of neighbors who seemed interested in feeding me had dwindled. At home, Andrea had ordered my groceries for me. It had been easier that way. She knew my schedule, so she'd planned my meals and made sure I had what I needed for the days I'd be in town. A part-time cook had prepared everything. I'd never needed to worry about making sure I had food around, just grabbed what was there and heated it up. Now that I wasn't playing football, and I wasn't home, I probably needed to start thinking about things like grocery shopping and meal planning. For now, I had one of Clarabelle's pepperoni rolls. I took it out and popped it in the microwave. Before I hit start, there was a knock on the front door. June poked her head in. "Hello," she said. "Can I come in?" That girl. My blood ran a little hotter at just the sight of her face peeking inside. "Hey, Junebug, come on in." Her hair was pulled back in a low ponytail, and she wore a gray cardigan over a white t-shirt and jeans. She held up a brown paper bag. "I brought food. I apologize for not calling or texting first. Perhaps you've already eaten, but Cassidy said I could be spontaneous if it included food." "Your sister knows one of the primary ways to a man's heart," I said. "But you can stop by any time, with or without a meal." June smiled. Every time she did that, I wanted to do a touchdown dance. I already knew June didn't give that smile to just anyone. I liked being the guy who got to enjoy it. I liked being the guy who got to enjoy her. She came into the kitchen and I took the bag, setting it down on the counter. I slipped my arms around her and pulled her close, leaned down and found her lips with mine. Thoughts ran through my mind, thoughts about June and Bootleg and maybe, just maybe, not going home to Philly anytime soon. But June and I hadn't had that sort of conversation yet. We hadn't put a label on this, and I wasn't sure how she was feeling about us. I pulled away, keeping my arms around her waist. "It's good to see you. Although it's been less than 24 hours since we were together, I was feeling a strong desire to be in your presence." I kissed the tip of her freckled nose. "You missed me." "Yes, I suppose that's true," she said, as if the notion surprised her. Hell, maybe it did. I gave her another quick kiss and let go of her so I could pull out the food she'd brought. The smell made my stomach rumble. "What have you been up to today?" I asked as I fished out a container of mashed potatoes. June got plates out of the cupboard. I noticed she didn't ask where they were. She'd made herself at home, and that little detail made me smile. "I worked until 4, then I had a meeting with Lula. She's looking to expand her business."
"Are you helping her out?"
She nodded, grabbing silverware out of a drawer.
"I often invest in businesses in town. I make more money than I need for myself, and I have an understanding of financial matters that some small business owners lack. It's a mutually beneficial arrangement."
"Sounds like it. What's Lula's business?"
"She owns the best spa in town. I helped her with her business plan last year, and the results were even better than projected. She'd like to reinvest the profits."
"That's awesome."
We dished up our plates, heaping piles of mashed potatoes next to slices of fresh-made meatloaf. June poured gravy from a small container over my potatoes, then hers, and we took our meals to the kitchen table.
"How many businesses have you invested in?" I asked.
She slid a bite of mashed potatoes into her mouth and swallowed before answering.
17. Jameson Bodine's girlfriend, Leah Mae Larkin, is the most recent. She's opening a clothing boutique. I secured an excellent rental rate on the storefront. What about you? How do you invest the income you earned playing football?"
"My assistant Andrea handles that for me." June raised her eyebrows.
"Does she? Is she a qualified financial planner?"
"Qualified enough for me. She's worked for me for years."
"Interesting," she said and took another bite. "What sorts of investments do you have?"
I shrugged, letting a spoonful of gravy-smothered potatoes melt in my mouth.
"A variety of things, I think. Mutual funds and so forth. I think there's some real estate in there."
"You think?"
Andrea has a handle on it, and I pay her very well to take care of things for me.
I read that it's very common for football players to struggle financially after retirement,
she said.
Are you careless with your money?
June's bluntness didn't faze me. It was an honest question, and at least part of me hoped she was fishing for information because she was sizing me up as a potential boyfriend. The truth? I was very careless with my money my first few years in the league. I was young and went from having not much to having a hell of a lot pretty much overnight. Blew a lot of money on stupid shit. I'm not proud of that. She took another bite and nodded. I got my act together, though. Not all guys do. In fact, I'd venture to guess most of them don't, especially the ones who stay single. I noticed the guys who seemed steadiest had wives or long-term girlfriends. I think the ones who found a good woman had an easier time being responsible with their money.
Statistics are clear. Married men live longer than single men.
I gestured with my fork. Indeed they do.
But you didn't get married. Did you have a long-term girlfriend who helped steady you?
I heard the hitch in her voice, and maybe it made me a bad person, but I liked the idea of June feeling jealous over me. No, not really. I dated the same woman off and on for a few years, but she wasn't good for my bottom line. The opposite, actually. Keeping her happy was expensive. She scrunched her cute little nose.
That doesn't sound like the basis for a good relationship.
It wasn't. No, I didn't have a woman to keep me in line, but I did see some things that made me think hard about how I was living. 3 years into the league, I was playing alongside Braden Santori in Seattle.
That was the year you had 137 receptions.
I grinned at that. Sure was. It was also the year that Braden had a career-ending injury. We were the same age, drafted at the same time. Neither of us were living like football was a short-term career. But there he was, suddenly out of a job. He didn't handle it too well.
What happened to him?
Less than a year later, he was out of money. He'd bought a fancy condo and a big mansion for his mom, new cars for himself and his family. His heart was in the right place, but without his football salary, he couldn't afford all the payments. Poor guy was 25 years old and had gone from being a millionaire to declaring bankruptcy.
That's quite the change.
Yep. I saw that happen to him, and it made me take stock of my own life and my money. I hadn't saddled myself with as much debt as he had, but I was living like money didn't matter.
Is that when you hired Andrea?
She came on board a little later, but more or less, yeah. I took another bite and looked down at my now empty plate. Thanks again for the food. I'm not sure where all mine went, but it was delicious. June grinned.
You ate that very fast.
It was so good. Once I started, I couldn't stop. I winked. Her cheeks flushed a slight shade of pink. I couldn't help but think about that blush creeping down her neck to her tits. My dick swelled, and I was glad I was wearing sweats. I half expected her to comment on my thinly veiled innuendo, but she didn't. She blinked at me a few times and went back to her dinner. So, Junebug, I've been thinking about something. I wanted to run it by you.
Yes?
I think we'd both agree we like seeing each other.
I would agree with that statement, yes.
Good. Seeing as how I'm no longer playing football, I find myself with quite a bit of freedom for the foreseeable future, especially when it comes to where I live.
That makes sense, particularly if you're financially stable.
Right, exactly. And I was thinking that instead of going home to Philly, maybe I'd stay here in Bootleg for a while.
Stay here?
She put her fork down.
I don't know why I repeated that as a question. I heard you quite clearly.
Maybe because what I said surprised you.
That is accurate, yes.
So, what do you think? She looked down at her plate, her expression unreadable. I could practically see the wheels in her head turning as she pondered my question.
As much as I wanted an enthusiastic yes out of her, seeing her consider my suggestion felt good. I liked that she was taking me seriously.
"Yes," she said, looking up to meet my gaze. "The question of whether or not you'd remain in Bootleg has been weighing on my mind. I would very much like it if you stayed."
I reached across the table and took her hand, squeezed it, then idly rubbed my thumb across her knuckles.
"Good. Then I will. I need to call Andrea and have her bring Mello out here." "Mello?"
"She's my bunny. I didn't tell you about my little marshmallow?"
"Do you spell it with an A or an E?"
"An E, even though I know it's not the proper spelling."
She shrugged.
"It's a name. I'll allow it."
"Well, thank you very much, Miss Dictionary."
"I'm not a dictionary, and that sounds like a mockery of a beauty queen title."
I laughed, which made her laugh. I squeezed her hand again. I was just teasing, but I am serious about bringing Mello out here. I miss my little furball. Her brow furrowed slightly.
"George, does bringing your bunny to live here with you in Bootleg Springs mean you and I are officially in a romantic relationship?"
I hesitated for a beat, about to say I'd like to think so, but I knew June preferred it when I was straightforward. "Yes, it does." That smile of hers lit up her eyes.
"Okay, I like that too."
"Me too, June Bug. Me too."
Chapter 14. June. Word spread like wildfire in Bootleg Springs. Whether it was good news or bad, nothing stayed quiet for long. Not unless we were all in agreement that we needed to keep our mouths shut or that one of our own needed protecting. But idle gossip, particularly where anyone's love life was concerned, was fair game. Within a day of George deciding to stay in Bootleg, I found myself at the heart of the second biggest story in town. The first, of course, was still the reappearance of Callie Kendall. But talk of the famous football player courting June Tucker had tongues running a mile a minute. I wasn't accustomed to being the center of so much gossipy attention. When I'd come up with the plan to get rid of the media by spreading a false story, I'd received my share of pats on the back, nods, and hat tips. But we'd been keeping that quiet, so the praise had been subtle, the way I preferred. This was different. Aside from an unfortunate stint with Hank Preston in high school, I'd never dated someone in town. I'd always kept my romantic interests, such as they were, quite separate from my community, and most people in town seemed to have decided I was destined to be single forever. It was never my name being paired up with someone in the paper. No speculation as to who would show up and sweep June Tucker off her feet. People had talked about Cassidy and Bowie, especially when word got out that they'd been dating in secret. Jameson had declared his intentions with Leah May for the whole town to see by stopping his truck in the middle of the street to kiss her. That had certainly generated a number of conversations. Scarlett had caused a stir when she'd started seeing Devlin, but Scarlett caused a stir all the time, so that hadn't been unusual. None of that had ever spilled over to me. I'd always been on the sidelines, quietly observing. Now the talk was about me, and it was weird. I'd been seen with George already. We'd danced at the lookout and shared meals at Moonshine. But something about the news that he had decided to stay in Bootleg Springs had set off the gossip wagon. Now it was rolling down the street right through the middle of town, on fire. I ignored the look Sierra Hayes gave me as I walked to the Bootleg Springs spa. She glanced around as if wondering why I was out and about alone now that I was part of a couple. If she had asked, I would simply have told her that George was with the Bodine men. Bowie had invited George to hang out with him and his brothers, and future brother-in-law, but I tended to think of Devlin as one of the Bodines now, despite his having a different last name. They were a unit, and they'd assimilated Devlin into their clan. I wasn't sure what their planned activities entailed. Bowie had deflected by saying man stuff. That sounded to me like watching sports, which was something I would have liked to be included in. But I understood the concept of male bonding, in theory at least, and Cassidy had invited me for a spa day. Spa treatments had numerous health benefits, and Lula ran the best spa in town.
and I had to admit, Lula's treatments did make my skin look very soft and touchable. It wouldn't be terrible if it made George more interested in touching me. I was the only one precisely on time, so I waited in the lobby, thumbing through a magazine I'd brought with me. Lula's waiting area was decorated with soft colors, wispy curtains, and comfortable furniture. Quiet music played in the background, something instrumental and soothing. A hint of citrus hung in the air, just enough to make it smell fresh yet calming. Liam May arrived, and a few minutes later, Cassidy and Scarlett. When our little group was all accounted for, Lula took us back. We donned fluffy bathrobes in the changing room and took our places in the treatment room. The air was warmer here, but dressed in just a robe, I was comfortable. I took a seat in a reclining chair, put my feet up, and pulled out my magazine. "Maybe we should go visit her," Scarlett said out of the blue. Cassidy settled into a chair. "Who?" "Callie Kendall," Scarlett said. "I can't stop thinking about her." "Same here," Liam May said. She twisted her long blonde hair into a bun and wrapped a hair tie around it. "Her disappearance was one of the defining moments of my life. It seemed like everything changed after that, and now it's just over." "Exactly," Scarlett said. "I'm still trying to wrap my head around it. I'm not sure.